Et Naim, Nikki Yasam Hilo, Nikki Machuptamaidu. Hello, everyone. My name is Hilo, and I'm Machuptamaidu. We acknowledge and are mindful that Chico State stands on lands that were originally occupied by the first people of this area, the Machupta, and we recognize their distinctive spiritual relationship with this land and the waters that run through campus. We are humbled that our campus resides upon sacred lands that have sustained the Machupta people for centuries and continue to do so today.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks for tuning back into our podcast, First Generation, One of Many. So today we have a super exciting episode, as always, waiting for you all to learn a little bit more about our current topic, which Josh is going to introduce later on. And so, of course, like I mentioned, welcome back to First Generation, One of Many. Our mission is to create an archive of discussions with and about first generation student experiences in and out of the classroom. We hope to continue raising awareness and understanding, provide voice for students and alum, as well as present resources for faculty, staff, and students working for and collaborating with first generation students. So again, the man of the hour, who also is my fellow co-host, would like to welcome and introduce Joshua Whitting Hill. What's up, Josh?
Not much, Teresa. What's up with you today?
No, not much. So it's actually been a pretty good day so far. A little bit of a rough morning start, but we're here.
I've been talking with people all week. And for some reason, even though it's Wednesday now when we're recording, All Monday, Tuesday, everyone's been having this sort of shared sentiment that it felt like Thursday afternoon the whole time, this whole week for some reason.
But
I'm loving the weather despite the 30 to 40 mile an hour winds around here today. It's just nice to look out and see the blue and the sun and seeing people out walking around and stuff has been great in the neighborhood. I'm really excited for today's episode to be able to bring in two people I consider role models, mentors, and friends that I've known for a while and have gone through a handful of different personal and educational experiences with. One of them gave me a kick in the butt one day and said, "Hey, why don't you go get a doctorate, man? It's about time you do that." And then the other one joined in the process along the way. We were already friends and we got to do that journey together and quite a bit of ups and downs and hotel rooms and different fun things though, and got to really learn a lot about each other and develop a relationship. And then sadly, he up and decided to move away from Chico. But it is great. We're going to have, these two people are Deanna Piero and Carmelo Miranda. Welcome, you two. How are you today?
Good. Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
You look red solo today. Thanks for having us.
And Deanna was a gracious host along with her partner, for me during the time of traveling to UC Davis and Sacramento for schoolwork, and let me crash in her house, and it was just a great time as well. Indeed. So our topic today is going to be about being first generation and in working and attending community college and what that experience is like comparatively maybe to a four-year school. And so both Carmelo and Deanna work in community college. So that's of course why we have them on the show today. And we're gonna give them a little background about them and then have a wonderful discussion. And first, as usual, we're gonna start off with a couple of quotes. And again, these were both offered up and shared with us by our guests. So Carmelo was saying that in able to do the work he does, he often refers to the quote he has written on his whiteboard right there behind him. It says, basically, simply, if there's a will, there's a way. And Carmelo, you want to expand on that a little bit?
So I always reflect on this quote because with the work that we do with our community college students, each student is different. We can't put them in the same basket as other students. So we, even though they're first generation students, they still have their own, they come with their own like set of circumstances that I have to figure out how to help them. So a long time passionate about helping students, I was trying to find a way to come with a solution. So that's why I would have that quote written on the whiteboard to kind of remind me every single day that there's always a solution. There's always a way to help these students.
You know, perfect. That's great. And sometimes, right, we find in our work there is often always three or four solutions sometimes, which helps students to have those choices and options depending on what we can do and what they can find out there. So thank you for that quote, reminder for us all. And the next quote was shared, Deanna picked it out for us, and it comes from John Lewis, the late great activist and civil rights activist. And he said, "Get in good trouble, necessary trouble, and redeem the soul of America." Deanna, thanks for sharing that. You want to talk a little bit about that, what that means to you, why you shared it? Because when I heard it and when you shared it, I thought, oh, that is Deanna right there.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear. I try to embody that as much as possible, I think, especially during these times, right? It's resonated with me more so than before. And I hope it resonates with our students who are also, and that quote's about having a voice when you're underrepresented and standing up for what's right. And I hope that our students can also learn to embody that themselves.
Yeah, thank you very much. And so let's get right into some bio information so the listeners can know a little bit more about each of you and then learn as we discuss after that. So Deanna Piero is a full-time faculty member at Woodland Community College and has worked in higher education since 2005. The bulk of her career has been spent working with and for underrepresented populations. Her doctoral dissertation and professional efforts revolve around increasing access and informalizing education. All right, welcome again, Deanna. Now, let's hear about Carmelo.
Yes, awesome. So my pleasure to introduce Carmelo Miranda, who is a first-generation student, which is one of the reasons why he enjoys working for educational support programs. His first-generation experience allows him to connect with students and assist them with their academic goals. Welcome to our episode, Carmelo. How are you doing?
Okay, thank you for having me. I'm doing rather well.
No, thanks again for being here with us. So definitely wanting to get to know you both a little bit better. And what better place to start than to ask, where did you both begin in your professional careers and what got you both into higher education? So we can start with Carmelo, if you would like to.
Yeah. So I think what got me interested in pursuing this career, I reflect a lot at the jobs that I had as a college student, as an undergraduate student. So I started at Sonoma State University and eventually got involved in their being a tour guide for Sonoma State, and then eventually also worked for admissions and records for the university. So just helping out students and just getting interact with students. And then when I transferred to Chico State, I got hired as a peer mentor for the student Student Support Services, SSS TRIO program. So I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed being an RA and just kind of helping students and talking to them and trying to figure out how to help them out and providing guidance. And when I graduated with my degree, I was working in the private sector in the healthcare, and I did not enjoy it. I dreaded going into the hospital. So I ended up quitting that job and just took time to really reflect what made me happy. And I always came back to helping students. So I decided to go back into education.
Can I brag about Carmelo for a minute?
Yes, we'd love to know more.
He didn't put it in there. It's not in there, but he is officially Dr. Carmelo Miranda also.
Oh, congratulations.
And did his doctoral research on working and supporting undocumented students. So just wanted to make sure we share that out there, because that's something that he has worked very hard at, went through a lot, and is amazing at what he's doing out there. So
appreciate that, Josh.
I do like to brag on Carmelo.
Should have added that into your bio. That's awesome. Perfect. Right. Deanna, what brought you into higher education, or what was your beginning?
Yeah, you know, I think it actually started in high school. I had quite an affinity for being a teacher, and as well as learning, of course. And so I had aspired at that time to be a PE teacher, got into college and realized that a kinesiology major, which is required for a PE teacher, requires a lot of science, which was not my forte per se. So I quickly switched over to, I think, my next best strength, which was English and composition. And during the undergrad, I was actually a tutor at the tutoring center at Fresno State University. And then for my graduate work, I was a TA. And so I think both of those experiences is actually what launched me into higher education. I would not be where I am without those experiences. And in fact, I'm still, part of my role now is overseeing tutoring services. So yeah, it's very much aligned with sort of my early beginnings.
Yeah, and you both mentioned kind of some of your work that you've done, and it touches on that you both have worked at 4-year and 2-year campuses now. So what are some differences and some similarities that you see for the students you're working with in these settings?
I guess I'll jump in here. Looks like Carmela might still be pondering that one. Well, I think, you know, there's obviously a lot of similarities, right? Both higher education institutions, our missions are very similar. Even programs that we offer are very similar. There's EOPS on one end and EOPNS on another, right? MESA programs are same but different titles. So I think all of that is very much similar. I think where we're most different is probably in our population sizes, right? And I know Carmela could agree with this, is that that poses some challenges for sure for community colleges and the work that we do. For any first generation, even low income programs, we do a lot of events, and that becomes tougher at a community college when your population size is a lot smaller. And then we're also not a residential campus. There's only, I think, 11 out of the entire 112 community colleges that are residential campuses. So most are not, and that poses other obstacles. You know, it's difficult to create communities for these students when, you know, there's not much of a community that exists on the campus itself. So I would say those are probably some of the greater disparities between the two.
And then for me, I've been at the college Winland Community College for 3 years now. So when I started, I realized the age difference of the students. Like for university, they're kind of more younger students, and the community college, not so much. So for me, it was getting used to working with students that are parents, that are older than me sometimes. And so trying to help them out with my life experience, even though they're older than me, just trying to like guide them and trying to reflect on how can I help them out. And Deanna mentioned about the events that we have. Sometimes it's difficult for students to attend events because some of them are working a full-time job and just taking classes here and there. So for me, it's adjusting to the student population and hearing more stories of perseverance that our students, for example, like especially with COVID, some of them lost their homes and living off in cars and trying to figure out how to do remote learning using whatever Wi-Fi they can. So it's just a different population of student and adjusting to that and making sure that I'm being helpful and hearing them out.
Yeah, I mean, you both are doing amazing work out there. And can I share a fun story about sort of events and what it takes and what you are doing to make sure you're supporting students? One of the first nights, Carmelo and I went down to Sacramento. We were going to meet Deanna for dinner because we were staying at her house. And we got a text from Deanna about 6:30. Oh, I'm going to run a little bit late. We're getting back from this event over in the Bay Area. And so we're waiting. Another half an hour goes by. Oh, we're still a little bit late. We're coming. We're almost there. And then by the time we got in touch with Deanna and she made it back to Woodland, to the campus, it was about 9:00. And then she said, oh, can you help? We need to get this van back to the airport, to the rental spot. And so Carmelo and I were driving around with her. And by the time we got done, though, the students that, you know, came back with her, she had said, you know, they were still with her at 9:00 coming back from the event, excited and pumped up about what they had done for the day. It was a great opportunity for those students to do something that they normally wouldn't have had in their day or their time, if it was like, hey, from 8 to 5, we have to do these things at this time only. So it really shows what you're doing. And then eventually the night wound up great. We've had some, I think we went to a pizza place that night because it was the only place that was open anymore by the time we got to dinner. But it
wow,
just shows.
Great memory there, man. That's a yeah. great story. I had almost completely forgot actually about that. And I think that, you know, says something that it just becomes such a normal part of our day when working with students that, you know, we'll stay longer, whatever, adapt to their schedules because we have to, that you forget that it's probably not normal for most. But yeah, good memory. That's a good one. Y'all really came through for me that night, by the way. So thank you both again.
Yeah. But I think it's also the connections, right, of just working in higher ed, understanding what those things mean and what it means to help, support. And then the last 12 months, there's been a lot more discussion around no matter what we're doing to help students, that we personally as staff and faculty are making sure we take care of ourselves. And we're not just doing everything that it takes to support students sometimes, because that means you're neglecting your own personal well-being at times. Yeah. And that seems to be come clear. But both of you have always done a good job about balancing and doing that for yourselves, for the most part, from what I've seen as well. Carmelo.
Carmelo's shake actually is perfectly, I think, indicative of where I'm at as well. So yeah, I agree, Melo. We can do better, I think.
Yeah, we could definitely do better.
Yeah. See, I don't see you for, I haven't seen you for a year, and now you're just going, oh, okay, you got to get back to where you were before in your personal care and areas.
Yeah, you would think since Bella doesn't have his dissertation work on anymore, he'd be in a better spot, but I don't know. Work is a different beast, I think.
Yeah, especially during COVID time. It's there's times that I work 12 hours just a day just because of the nature of adjusting to COVID and providing the same services. But our students are pretty much all over the place. But yeah.
Yeah. And it's definitely something too that COVID has done. And I feel like Josh and I have had this conversation a lot with our coworkers and also our other guests on our episodes is what COVID has illuminated in needs of our students, especially within our own students within the EOP program and just in other programs or in higher ed overall in general. And we've spoken about some of those issues, but in regards to the experience for both of you, what are situations, issues, or concerns that you see that are crucial that we need to be talking about regarding first generation student personal and academic achievements? And whoever's ready can take this one. Carmelo, yeah, you're ready.
I want to touch a little bit about that regards to the work that I did in the master's program, because I try to focus on technology integration with first generation students. Mm-hmm. How we as educators assume that students know how to use technology for academics, but they're using technology for social media, gaming, and other things. Some of it could be transferred over to academics, but working in this community college, one thing that I understood right away is that students lack the understanding how to effectively use a laptop or how to use Microsoft or Excel or how to open a PDF or even how to do reading using digital material. So there's a lot of things that students, our first generation students, need to understand before they get a college is how to do some of the basic stuff. One thing that comes to mind, a story is that I was helping a student. It's like, oh, you need to just download the PDF and then open the document and you'll be able to get access to information. And then it took a while, but then it came back to me. It's like, how do you open and download a PDF? Like for me, I was like, you know, I thought it was a simple process, but for the student, it was a huge challenge. So just things like that, it's just adjusting to the student. And so COVID kind of brought that into light more is that one, a lot of our first generation students lack the proper technology to at home to be able to do their academics. Especially with now they're using Proctorio for exams and some of their laptops are not up to date. So they got to figure out how to get another laptop. They might not have good Wi-Fi to stay connected all the time via Zoom. I actually had to invest a lot myself in getting my Wi-Fi up to par in order to be on Zoom because it was a struggle at the beginning. But I'm very fortunate to have the funds to do that. Now, most students do not. So just things like that came into light, but a lot of it is just helping students understand how to use technology a little bit more effectively for their academics.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that one.
Mm-hmm. I would say, this is a really good question, by the way, because I think there's something that's really big that's usually left out of the conversation when talking about first generation students. One, we know obviously financial hardships often coincide with being first gen, right? Is also being low income. And that means often a tremendous impact on even students' access to food and housing, for example. And so for me, I think, shelter and food insecurity is often left out of the conversation when discussing first generation population, unfortunately. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that we've done a tremendous job in finding ways to celebrate and find pride in being first gen, right? With the whole new me first movement, right? That folks are now saying, I am first and that's a good thing. But we have not been able to find the same pride, obviously, in self-identifying as food or shelter insecure, right? For obvious and good reasons. And so with that, what ends up happening in turn is that then students don't feel comfortable in talking about those things and sharing those things. And yet they're dealing with these hardships that ultimately impact their academic achievement. And so I think that's one that's very critical to the conversation that we need to do better at and find ways to open the door for students to feel comfortable to discuss those things, maybe providing panels where own faculty and staff maybe share some of their stories in the past of dealing mm-hmm. with those hardships. But that is absolutely a critical piece that I think is not discussed enough.
Yeah, and that even goes back to one of our episodes. We were talking with some faculty from the College of Agriculture and a student from that area, and that was one of the main issues they were talking about in their different field within agriculture of how they're trying to address this and look at that situation now that it's becoming more to the forefront of not even just first-generation students, but a lot of students, in general, in the whole population are facing more food insecurity in the last 5 to 10 years, and it's coming to light now with different basic needs programs and things that are popping up around higher education areas. So if you're living near a place where there is a university or a community college, you may even have a little bit more access. But if you're living somewhere that's a little bit farther away from any kind of campus in higher education, some of those resources might be a little bit less at this right. time. But it's an excellent point and so many to move forward, because there was always this sort of, the joke or the myth of like, I'm a college student, I eat top ramen all the time and that's it. But it was always more serious. And now we see the impacts of that on students. Now you mentioned first generation students in that realm and connected to community college. It seems like it's like what Carmelo mentioned about the age of students at community colleges being different than at the four-year schools. And that means quite often a lot of community college students come to school already as parents or guardians as well, compared to coming into a four-year school. So we see that impact. It's more than just the student. It's also people that they are responsible that they're taking care of as well.
Yeah. I think there is something there, Josh. And Carmelo, I don't know if this has been your experience, but for me, I feel like we've been helping a lot more students. A greater portion of our students have, self-identified as housing or food insecure at the community college level. It is very prominent. It's been an interesting experience in that regard. You're right. It's correlation. Yeah,
and in working with students and colleagues and community members and things that we're doing, can the two of you, maybe for time's sake, because we have a few other questions we really want to get to that we have here, but for this one, if each of you can maybe share and talk about one specific framework that you utilize or that you see being utilized on your campus that really helps support the mission and the goal of what your campus is doing. Not everyone at once.
I guess I'll jump in on this one. Just because I think this is a really good question as well. I think in terms of, theoretical frameworks, I think even if it's unknowingly, a lot of these programs are built or should be built on the idea of cultural and social capital, right? We recognize that our students are coming to us with already some type of cultural capital in their own right, but also linking them to, the culture of the institution and showing them how to navigate that.
as well as hopefully linking them to faculty and peer mentors as a way to access social capital. But for me, in my dissertation work, and you mentioned it in the bio earlier, that I realized that really accessing cultural and social capital comes from informality and creating informal spaces. And so I can't necessarily speak to the college campus and their mission, but I can say for my work, as far as my work is concerned, I always look for ways to infuse informality into the programs that I run. And that's, again, we recognize and have found in my research that in those informal spaces, students are more inclined to ask those questions that they otherwise felt uncomfortable asking, and making those connections with faculty and other peers that provide them that social capital. So for me, that is certainly the guiding framework of the work that I do, and I think the work that we should be doing in all realms.
Okay, time to brag on Deanna now. It's Deanna brag time. So one of our recent episodes, we had two staff and two students from CSU Chico's REACH program, and that is developed and based on informality in higher education. But of course, it would have never been started. It was founded by Deanna. So if you haven't listened to that episode, you can learn more about what Deanna is talking about informality and a little bit of how these things happen outside of the classroom.
You're absolutely right. That entire program was built on that framework. The connections with the faculty, with the peers, the events is all informality. And you know, that program is now thriving because of it. And so it's just something that we don't know a lot about and maybe even do it subconsciously, but certainly we should be looking at ways to infuse that into our work even more so.
Thanks for that. Hey, sure. And it is a program that has a population a little bit under 200, but the data showing the last number of years that the retention rates for students in the REACH program are above the campus average, for retention of all other students. So it is doing something, obviously, to help students in that part, but even more so, it's helping students in their personal growth. I think a lot of just of developing as people and learning about who they are, what they want to be doing, where they want to be going, and having a goal towards their future as well.
Awesome.
All right, Carmelo, do you have a specific framework in mind, conceptual or theoretical?
One that, based on the dissertation I did, was Yoso Community Cultural Wealth Framework and also Validation Theory, where sometimes the educational system does not include students' own knowledge. They don't value that, or the knowledge that they gain from their family. We tend to see it as not important. But with Yoso's Community Cultural Wealth Framework is it highlights that students come to campus with a lot of knowledge, information, and that they're tapping to different resources. And we just need to do a better job at understanding those resources they come with and acknowledging that they are of value. Not that they come into the college for us to give them value, but also kind of the other way around. So I think about what MESA is doing in regards to hearing our students, hearing their voices and hearing their stories and validating their experience and saying, you're right, you know, you're definitely come with a lot of good information. Let's use that, let's tap into that. So just to give Deanna a shout out too, she's the one that kind of brought that model into the MESA program. So she kind of, you know, the REACH stuff, but also brought all the same value to MESA here at Willing Community College.
Great. And maybe just to add to a little bit for listeners that may not be familiar with these frameworks, right? The first one of community cultural wealth looks at specific capitals and how we as faculty or staff working with students, how can we help them connect to those and see that those capitals carry over into education? And I think there's about six, right? So we can look at, there's navigational capital, resistant capital, familial capital, social capital, navigational capital. Did I say that one already? And then linguistic, right? What else do we leave off?
Aspirational capital.
Thank you. Aspirational capital. So those are in there in different ways. So if you're interested in that, we're going to put that in the show notes. We'll put a link to some work by Tara Yoso, and you can see some of the literature that's been out there. We'll share some of that. The second one is really, I think, interesting and important because it was started in the early 90s on community college campuses with Laura Rendon Linares did some work on validation theory and got a lot of her data and information, like I said, from community colleges because she was seeing increasing numbers of students identify as female. There was more parents and guardians. There were more veterans. There were more former foster youth students. And just she started seeing these populations growing and more first generation students. And so that really is an amazing framework as well. And students had a lot to say about what's important, right? For us as faculty and staff to be aware of and be contributing to. And it comes down to one of the most basic ones of validation theory that came out of that research is that, hey, when faculty and staff know my name, I feel like I belong. Like, you know, that was one of the more basic results that came out of it as well. So thanks for sharing that one. That's great. All right.
I also like learning about new frameworks too, because it kind of helps, because I even messaged Josh and I was like, what was the first one? Why haven't I heard about this one? And I immediately Googled it on my other screen over here because I'm always trying to find different ways and develop my methods and new skills and sharpen my skills in terms of working with my students overall. So definitely something, a resource to look into for our listeners as well as myself. And when with the diversity of the students that you all work with, especially coming from a community college, what are some methods or things that you would all recommend that you see that would be best, the best ways to support students, transfer students when going into or transferring into a four-year school? And this one can be tough. I feel like there's maybe so many things that one can think about and how to best ease that transition. But Diane, do you have any recommendations for us?
Deanna, but yeah.
Apologies for that.
It's all good. I think this is an interesting question because I think transfer students are often overlooked. Partly because they fare really well when they get into four-year institutions. And in fact, the data shows that they have higher success rates than first-year students. So, but in result of that is that then we focus all our efforts on first-year students at the four-year college, right? Because they need the most assistance. However, in that, what I think happens is that we establish communities that these students are a part of in the community college. And then when they transfer, they lose those communities and those aren't necessarily reinvigorated for them and or recreated for them at the four-year college. I think we can do a lot better in creating programs that are actually dedicated and for transfer students. I don't think we've gotten there yet. None that I heard of have done that successfully, but I think it's definitely a part of the conversation that we need to continue.
I definitely agree with Diana and what she said. There's one program I do want to highlight. It's at UC Berkeley. They have a transfer program to help students kind of ease into UC Berkeley. But I definitely agree with Diana that, like, I'm reflecting back, and I have students that left MESA from my community college, but they always come back to me for help. They're at Sacramento State. They're at UC Davis. They're one at UC Santa Barbara, and these students, although they're not part of the program anymore, they always come back, and it's like, hey, Carmelo, I need help getting this resource or finding this and X, Y, and Z. And I think a lot of it has to attribute to what Deanna was mentioning. There's no real support at the college once they get to the four-year university to help them move forward. Although we do encourage our students to apply to support programs at the universities, not all of them do get into those programs. So once they're left out, they're kind of back on square one, kind of figuring things out on their own. Especially, it's kind of difficult if you're moving far away. For example, the student at UC Santa Barbara, they're far from where they're originally born and raised. So I think that's one of the biggest things that four universities could do is help develop a center and program for transfer students. I'm trying to think if Chico State has one. Josh, maybe you would know, but I can't think of any program that Chico State has specifically only for transfer students.
There are different efforts and discussions happening to try and make that, you know, become a little bit more. There are a few courses that were started up this last year as connection courses. One was developed for transfer students. And so that rolled out this last fall. And then hopefully it continues next fall for students. Within EOP, we try and do some specific work for transfer students. But it is a slow process, unfortunately, to get some of these things going. We were able to bring in a new advisor and admissions tech or admissions specialist for transfer students in EOP. But of course, she was only working with us for about 3 to 4 months. And then we've been working remote. So a lot of efforts are kind of on hold to really hopefully engage transfer students a lot more accessibly. But, you know, she is doing and EOP is doing what they can for that group of students. But yes, the bigger picture of transfer support then is usually kind of sparsed out to individual colleges and departments. And some things are happening slowly in those areas as well to raise support for transfer students, of course. Teresa, anything else that you think of on campus for transfer students specifically? Because you meet with different groups.
Yeah, let's see, specific programs geared towards transfer students. I can't think of any off the top of my head. I've also been on campus for a year. I mean, a couple of months physically, but right. No, I know. But one thing I can say is that I definitely recognize, have seen and been observant that the need for these support programs to exist for transfer students is evident and has been recognized. And there are programs working towards structures to be able to create that and implement them in their programs for transfer students specifically. EOP being one, I'm trying to work around or trying to see how we can develop that with the help of our coworker who specifically works with transfer students in EOP. But I would say that that's a great start to an extent that it's recognizing it and validating that these transfer students, you know, do at least need a touch program for to be able to ensure their continued success and support. So, but I would love to re-record this podcast in a year or 2 years from now and see what programs we can actually highlight on here, which is I'm excited about because I definitely think there will be a few.
Yeah. And then of course there is the orientation and new programs that have some stuff specific for transfer students as far as coming in and that beginning part of the experience, but it's the experience after, right, that they come in and are on campus. Let's see, and I think, unfortunately, we are hitting that wall of time pretty hard. We moved fast. That was a quick 50 minutes to get to this point. And so we're going to need to go ahead at this point in time and go into our recommendations of what we'd want to share with the listeners today. All right, then, Carmelo, do you have a recommendation to share with us today?
I do. Although we didn't talk a lot about DACA or undocumented students at a community college, and that's really my focus in my dissertation work, I would highly encourage your listeners to check out Immigrant Rising website. It has a lot of good resources for educators to learn more about how to help undocumented students, but also for undocumented students out there, there's specific scholarships out there that you could apply to. So definitely check out that website.
Excellent. Thank you. That is definitely needed, right? And a lot of people working in higher education are working with DACA students and not even necessarily know they're working with DACA students. So just to have the information and knowledge when all of a sudden you are aware of someone or some people you're working with who are DACA students, you can have some of that to share and be supportive in that as well. All right, Deanna, do you have a recommendation for us today?
Yeah, just sort of going along the lines of some of the things I mentioned earlier today about shelter and food insecurity, which we realize, you know, impacts our students and their success is, you know, the access to money and scholarships. And I'd like to recommend first risefirst.org, which is a website focused solely on first generation students and provides a nice comprehensive list of scholarships. And you can sort by location, California and college and all of that, so that you can find scholarships and sort of easy money, I think, in a lot of ways for students. And so students don't generally, I think they're intimidated by the process of applying for scholarships a lot of the time and don't really realize that and it's actually easier than we think to get awarded. So yeah, please check that out.
That's great. Yes, another great resource, right, for everyone out there. And I have one for today. It came out recently, and it's from the 21st Century Commission on the Future of Community Colleges. They published a report titled Reclaiming the American Dream, Community Colleges and the Nation's Future. And so it really kind of is a synopsis and a look at what community colleges are facing as far as different challenges. And it has about seven that are listed there, and then some discussion about how to move forward from there and to kind of say, to share the impact of it and what it means. In response to this, Dr. Walter Bumpus, who's the president of the American Association of Community Colleges, in an interview said, "For years, we've been focused on access, and now we need to turn our attention equally to student access. It takes courage to say we can do better." And so it is a wonderful report and has a lot of these, like I said, a lot of different issues and concerns in there and challenges that community colleges are working with right now and trying to work through. And so all of us working in higher education then will be impacted by some of these in one way, whether we work with students who transfer to a four-year school or you're at a community college, and you may see some of these things they talk about in the report as well. That's mine for today. And Teresa, yes, what's on your mind today?
Well, I know I usually have a recommendation, but I can't think of much right now. I feel for me for this episode, I absorbed a lot and I learned a lot about what our topic today. So if I do have a recommendation, it would be for our listeners to go ahead and look up these frameworks and the different theories that were mentioned, because a lot of them might be something similar to what you're already doing or something that you are willing to explore to better help and serve your student populations. So, and I know that as far as educators, faculty and staff, we're all passionate about that and working towards finding new ways to be able to develop our skills to better serve our, you know, ever-changing population of students, which is amazing. And so I want to thank both of our guests for being with us here today. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedules with work and just life in general and joining us. So again, shout out to both of you for being here today. And to our listeners for tuning in, thank you again for supporting us. Our podcast, First Generation, one of many. So I would bid a farewell to you, Carmelo, and to you, Diana. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And since you all been so gracious in giving shout outs today, I just want to give a shout out to both of you for creating this and making this happen for students. It's just I think a very creative way of providing resources for students and, you know, getting at their level and speaking their language and doing that during this time is perfect. I mean, it makes it, you know, accessible. So just great job all the way around. And thanks for having us.
Yep. All right. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Goodbye.